Every year, 1.2 million children are sold into slavery across the globe. Your favorite webcomic creators have joined forces as the Comic Creators for Freedom, fighting together to end human trafficking with over 100 artists create one image in the hopes of spreading awareness and raising money to help fight this heinous crime. For information on how you can participate or also contribute to the annual fundraising drive, which begins this year on January 9th through the 20th, visit www.comiccreatorsforfreedom.com and learn more.
News and commentary on the Webcomic Beacon newscast.
All right, welcome to the Webcomic newscast number 48. I'm a guest, T. Campbell, who's assembled a list of items for your more usual hosts to discuss, and rather than introduce them all and all their many fine qualities, which I'm probably not familiar with anyway, I figured I'd just go around and we could start introducing ourselves. Eric, why don't you go next?
Eric is not actually going to be on this podcast, but my name is Eric Kimball, and I am the news collector. I am here just as a technical assistant, and I will be silent from this point on. But thanks for introducing me, T. Tom, how about you?
Well, the part of Eric Kimball will be played by Hervé Villachez today. I'm Thomas Revoir, the usual host of the Webcomics newscast, and the person in charge over at 910 Comics. That's 910cmx.com. Let's go over to you, Alex.
There's no Alex here.
There's no Alex.
Yeah, sir. Well, see? This is what you get for not having me at the meetings. Adam, we'll switch over to you.
I'm Adam. Does that count?
This is well, Adam I got one letter right.
This is Adam Smithy. I am the host of the Tropecast, and I'm here to provide non-scientific humorous color commentary.
And we also have Ross Scott, who's here, who was the former Webcomic Beacon newscast. Welcome back.
Hey, everyone. Ross. That's all the things I would say about myself, and you just said them. I have a website. You should go to it. It's systemcomic.com, and I'm also the MC of Super Art Fight, which is awesome.
Sorry, just trying to keep the dead air to a minimum here. I'm Fess. The guy who does the sister podcast, the Webcomic Beacon podcast, I would like to remind everybody that is the older sister podcast of the Webcomic Beacon newscast.
Much older.
So anyway,
hey, we still get carded. So
yeah.
All right. This is an end of the year retrospective. Probably would not have existed if one of us, namely me, wasn't obsessive enough to actually look at all the news items related to comics over the year and try to figure out which stories were most important. In some cases, it was a single headline whose significance made itself clear immediately. In other cases, it was sort of an amalgamation of several headlines that seemed to form into one larger story. I originally composed a list of 15 items, but there was one that nudged its way into the mix at the very last in the very last days of December, and so we've ended up with 16 in all. We'll be going down these as quickly as we can, which means that the actual cast will probably finish on January 27th. But
which year?
Indeterminate. But I'd like to begin with a sort of evergreen story that got a couple of new shades this year. Gender in the comics field, particularly comic books and web comics. Eric was the first to notice, I think, that that there were approximately 18 octillion stories about Kate Beaton floating through the blogosphere and the news spectrum in general. It's a bit like what happened to XKCD a couple of years ago and Penny Arcade a couple of years before that. However, it is, even though these features are repetitive in a way that's irritating to those of us who cover comics news, it is significant, I think, that Kate Beaton, as well as some other figures like Danielle Corsetto and Meredith Gran, are considered to be representative and as cartoonists rather than representative of a small exotic minority, which is the treatment that seems to get extended to women working in the comic book field. Things got particularly controversial at DC Comics when they announced their new creative lineup for their New 52 line of comics, and the number of female creators actually dropped.
Sharply.
Yes, this is the comic book field, and the comic book field continues to be largely influenced by a guy's genre, and there are and we see the consequences of that, sadly, on a fairly regular basis. This is a very significant issue, and it would have been higher on my list if it had felt like things had really changed that much this year. And that's all I have on that. Would anyone else like to weigh in?
Well, I think that it's actually very interesting because we've also had a couple of, I don't want to say organizations, a couple of conglomerations, a couple of groups that have sprung up of female webcomic creators. For some reason, the only one that sticks out in my mind right now, I'm thinking of the gal who created Red String and has a number of comics under her belt as well from other people.
Yep.
And then Filthy Figments, which is also an all-female, adult-oriented webcomic organization.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we are seeing, the print versus webcomics, we're seeing a lot more freedom for not just creators, but creators of a specific type, specific genre. And we're seeing a lot more females come out in webcomics because of that freedom.
Additionally, I do need to get this out there. Not everybody has heard of this, but if anybody who knows Spike, who does Templar Arizona, she has the money in the bank to commission several artists to do basically a porn anthology printed book. It is started already, but I believe it was started within the last year.
It was this year.
It's called Smut Peddler. And it sounds like she's going to actually do a Kickstarter and see if she doesn't have to actually dig into her savings. But it's like, you know, that's pretty gutsy there. I mean, if she
there was also a what was it called, Womanthology or something, Comixology? I forget the name.
Womanthology.
Which one?
Womanthology.
Womanthology. Yeah. That was huge this year. And a bunch of others. I mean, yeah, I feel like this is the story that keeps coming up every year. I mean, every year it's like, oh, right, women, comics. Yes, women in comics. That's the thing.
Yeah, maybe next year it'll be higher up on the list, though.
And, you know, it's not that it shouldn't keep coming up, because it should. It should come up to the point where everybody starts saying, duh. I mean, and that's a good thing. But, I mean,
It should. The question is whether to weigh it as a story. I always look at the situation and say, well, what's different this year than as opposed to this time last year?
Well, you know, there's this there's this article that keeps getting redone every couple months that is webcomics are a thing now, you know, or any article about webcomics where the first two paragraphs are, so people are putting comics on the internet now, you know, and you have those articles and they've been around as long as webcomics have, and if not longer, and as in the same sort of way, you know, the articles about women in comics used to be, you know, this very introductory sort of thing where they used to start with, oh, there are women in comics now. And now the articles have shifted in a good way to being, so we all know there are women in comics. Here's what's going on now. And so it started to get more kind of accepted that everyone knows that they're already there in a better way than it used to. Mm-hmm. I think if you compare the articles to a year ago or 2 years ago, that's the bigger difference, is that it popularly more familiar with it already.
Well, I think that there's two different layers operating simultaneously here. One is external to comics. Comics themselves have a degree of social unacceptedness. And then inside comics, for so long, it's been a male-dominated thing. The women in comics...
Certain sectors of comics.
Certain sectors of comics. But it's kind of almost like a double rainbow sort of thing, which is why people get so fascinated with it. It is good that it's moving away from being a news story on its own, that, you know, like, yes, there are people with ovaries who draw things. And
which is why the whole subject's being discussed right now by a bunch of guys.
Yes, oh, yes. We usually have at least one woman on this cast, don't we?
Usually. And it isn't for lack of trying.
I try to get at least one woman on any of the Webcast Beacon Network programming. In fact, one of them is hosted by a woman, so I think I'm doing good.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You're doing better than DC.
Moving on. Moving on to the next item, Marvel's Summer at the Movies. This year may be the strongest argument yet for Marvel's overall film strategy. Minor distraction here. I'm sure it can be smoothed out in post.
Sure.
It has had three summer movies, each of them clearing the $150 million mark. Reviews have generally been positive for each film, and Marvel's identity as a film studio seems to be on increasingly solid ground. The question that always comes up when film strategy is discussed is, what is this going to mean for the comics? And what it means for this over to the next person.
Well, we say, because we could talk about the three Marvel movies as well, and DC had Green Lantern, which was okay. it made a profit. It made a good profit enough that they're going to have a sequel. But, I mean, I always focus back with the movies nowadays, especially with the movies that Marvel is making, to Batman Begins, Dark Knight, and the Sam Raimi Spider-Man films, where the medium was taken seriously. It wasn't the camp that we had from the original or the later Batman films, but it was a straightforward, done correctly type of comic book to movie.
I would argue the Burton Batmans were awesome.
They were good for the time, but Jack Nicholson as the Joker was... he was no Mark Hamill.
Speaking of this year in comics, though, I mean, did you guys read on Comics Alliance they had a guy who rewatched all the Batman movies? And he rewatched Batman and Robin, which is, you know, cheesiest of the cheese. And it's actually gotten way better than you remember, because it's so bad it's kind of good. In a way that... Like, in the 90s, the idea of so bad it's kind of good didn't really exist. But now, you know, there's so much in our culture that is riffing, so bad it's kind of good.
I really hate to tell you this, but irony was invented before the 1990s.
Yeah.
I mean,
it wasn't really...
I don't know. I mean, my buddies were watching movies that were so bad they were good in high school and college, and that was the 1990s.
I think it's more mainstream now.
Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yeah, back me up.
Rick D's Disco Duck can't say anymore.
But I think a lot of the internet has reached to that sort of making fun of things that are bad.
Technically a comic book movie.
Yeah.
But it really is. The whole thing is showing what can be done when you take something right. I mean, if you even look at things like Cowboys and Aliens, which fortunately I didn't see, but I heard not so good stuff on it.
There's a lot of controversy to that one. I think we had in a previous thing. It started out as a pitch. The movie people wanted more to it, so they ended up making a comic. Then they went back. After they had a comic, they got the movie deal. They ended up changing the name so they didn't have to pay several writers out of technicalities. It's just Platinum, fuck you. Sorry.
But it was also,
I think that actually gets to the heart of what's been going on, which is that right now, more than ever, people are caring less about the medium and more about the message.
Exactly. And they're going outside of the traditional methods. I mean, it's not just superheroes anymore. 2010 had one of the best movies ever, Red, with Bruce Willis and a cast, an unbelievable cast. And that was based off of a comic book movie, a comic book from Vertigo.
Well, what about Walking Dead? You know, great TV show, did awesome this year, and, you know, started out as a comic book too. No one even cares that started as a comic book. It's just good.
And, I mean, we're going to be seeing the reboot of Superman again. And we're seeing so many other things that are coming out that we are going to be having.
Which leads very, very nicely to our next topic. One particular movie that I'd like to single out for your attention, and that would be The Adventures of Tintin. This would be number 14.
I haven't seen it yet.
Well, I won't tell you very much, except that it's extremely faithful to the source material, and while kind of lukewarm in the United States, it's earned about $26 million so far. It has done gangbusters business in Europe, where Tintin's fan base has always been strongest. This is the most popular comic to come out of Western Europe, and its success in a faithful film adaptation may point the way toward others. I don't know if you guys have a whole lot to say about this one, particularly if you haven't seen it, but I'm opening up the floor nevertheless.
Well, I will say I haven't seen the movie yet, but I've been a fan of Tintin for a long time. I mean, when Herge created it back in the 1930s, I mean, there was a lot of it, and the story of how he was able to get this published during World War II itself is an adventure all its own. So, I mean, Tintin, even with the original very dated, very comic-y style that it had, it ought to make a great movie, but ought to and is are two different things. We're also going to have to dip into the Uncanny Valley.
I believe we had an interesting opportunity with this because we had another movie come out this year, which is actually a considerable parallel to Tintin, and that's the Smurfs movie.
Yep.
Because both of them are European-based comics, but Smurfs had a huge hold here in the United States, whereas Tintin didn't. And Smurfs deviates so far from the source material because they had to Americanize it for us stupid Americans between the cartoons and all the different stuff that they've done over the years that I seriously doubt the original creator would recognize the new Smurfs movie as his own work. Now compare that to Tintin, which is like a spot on pulled straight out of the pages sort of thing. And you see, I'm not surprised it's not doing well here in the United States because obviously most people here have not heard of it.
Well, they're stupid because that's awesome.
I'd like to get something that we've never heard of it. I'm just saying that's why it's not going gangbusters here, and I just hope that they don't take the failure of it in the United States as a failure of the medium itself. It'd be like,
they've already got a sequel lined up.
It'd be like if the first time they did a 3D broadcast, nobody in the United States watched it, and so they assumed 3D TV was dead, but it was because they were broadcasting cricket.
Yes, the European dollars are enough for them. I believe the sequel has already been greenlit. Now there is a hole in my understanding here. I know that the Smurfs was not a critical success. Was it a commercial success?
Oh, yeah. Failure? Huge success.
Oh, well.
Sigh.
Oh, NPH. So, it wasn't... the Smurfs movie was not painful to watch. Not like the Chipmunks movie, for instance,
which wasn't actually comparable to dental surgery. Okay, gotcha.
All right, maybe we should just move on.
Right. Yes. Point 13 is the death of Steve Jobs. I considered calling this story the retirement of Steve Jobs because what's really relevant is
it's been going on all year.
Retirement from the public sphere. But honestly, I think that only death would have prevented him from continuing to influence the world as much as he was able.
I'm glad you said that, because even now, I mean, one of the big stories about this was that before his passing, he already had a 4-year plan set up for his passing and new products lined up. Jobs is always... I hate to sound like an Apple fanboy.
Yeah, he honestly micromanaged his own death.
Yeah.
How's your plans on that coming?
Yes, quite amazing. In terms of the relevance to comics, his primary effect was the release of the iPad 2 early this year and the continued management of properties that are allowed onto Apple marketplaces, which has serious implications for those of us who are looking to make a profit off these things. The advantage of Apple's closed system is that it's much easier to make money with it. And sell items directly to people who might otherwise expect to get them for free. The disadvantage is that closed means controls, and those controls have traditionally been Apple's. I think that will change in the years to come, but probably not as soon as certain creative people would like.
But I also think that it was a big thing because the way that he dealt with the old industries in the television, movie, and music industries changed the way that the game was played, especially with the electronic field coming out. And that has a major blowback as the publishing industries are beginning to learn the same lessons now. So, I mean, the way that we deal with business and the major publishing companies deal with business has definitely been a game changer because of Steve Jobs.
It's true. It's probably worth a cast of its own to examine how the media landscape is changing and how that affects our little corner of it. Anybody else?
Okay. I don't know about you guys, but I'm on a MacBook Pro right now, and I got an iPhone in my pocket. And, I've been on Apple products for as far back as I can remember at this point. You got to give it up for that.
Yay,
all I can say is that I want to see Noah Wiley play Steve Jobs in the movie. Again. Not George Clooney.
And this rolls right into our next topic. Kind of, yes.
Fallen heroes. Cartoonists have been alienating their fans with ugly beliefs for a very long time, probably as long as there have been newspaper cartoons. Some of the examples that roll off my tongue or Dave Sim, Johnny Hart, and Al Capp, and you can just look those guys up because this isn't a 100-year retrospective. But this was a very bad year for two cartoonists who had been considered sort of populist heroes in the 80s and 90s, respectively, Frank Miller and Scott Adams. Frank Miller, with a largely uninformed rant about the Occupy movement and several other things that just seemed to demonstrate an increasingly black and white vision and a general sense that he's losing his ability to observe the times that served him so well in The Dark Knight Returns. And Scott Adams, with a meal of sexist statements, garnished with a sort of smug verbal gamesmanship. He paints himself as being sarcastic in this sort of catch-22 way that seems very familiar to people who've spent a lot of time reading Dilbert strips, but you're not actually supposed to emulate the management in those.
Yeah. Well, I think both of these are really, at their core, examples of the same thing, which is we live in a much more open opinion world with the internet than we ever have before, and it's changing all the time. And now, more than ever, celebrities and artists and whoever have blogs and have Twitter and have Facebook and have all these things that let them get their message out without it going through a PR agent or a publisher, to the point where now we are just like, from what I understand, the big backlash after Frank Miller was everyone saying, Frank Miller's insane, Frank Miller's crazy. And then other people saying, Frank Miller's always been crazy. You just don't see him. Like, I think it was, Oh, man, why am I blanking on his name? Created Cable. Oh, what was his name?
Rob Liefeld.
Rob Liefeld had a great post about the internet and Frank Miller and a bunch of other things that honestly really redeemed Rob Liefeld to me.
Yeah, but he has a guide of how to deal with trolls.
Yeah, it was really smart. And the thing about it is he said, you know, Frank Miller's always been like this. If you know Frank Miller at all, which he has, he'll tell you that, you know, Frank, that's just the way Frank Miller is. It's just that, you know, that's not what all got published. Only the good stuff got published. And that's what we're seeing now, is a lot more of people just taking straight to it. And there's a lot of people that we know by their personality. But these are people who we didn't really know their personality. And the more their personality comes out, the less we like them.
Back right. In the 60s, when President Johnson was still in office, the reporters got so intrusive that in a famous moment he literally ripped off his shirt and showed an appendectomy scar. We're seeing a bit of that nowadays, where everybody has to know everything about everybody.
Well, now it'd be a twit-tick, but
yeah. And combine that with the ultra sensitivity that we've seen from the politically correct movement, anything that anybody says is going to be immediately taken offensive of. I mean, I've literally had someone get angry at me because I said, have a nice day. So we're whether Frank Miller or not is insane or people agree with him, the fact that such a big stink over something that somebody said shows something about the society that we're in now as well.
Anything you say can and will be used against you.
I don't doubt in any degree that Frank Miller is insane. I think Scott Adams was trying to stir up controversy to try and stay relevant, and that it burnt him. Because seriously, who says stuff like that? Even if you believe it, there's got to be, I mean,
yeah, don't you know somewhere in your head, I am saying something that most people disagree with.
Doesn't stop me.
I think that he was just trying to stay relevant. I mean, Dilbert's, what, like 15 years out now? And he wrote all those books back in the 90s, and everybody gave them to everybody else and made them feel good, and they put them on coffee tables, and then they gave them to Goodwill, and they threw them away, and it doesn't matter anymore.
It's true. Scott Adams hasn't been a story for a while.
He's going to do Garfield range.
No such thing as bad publicity.
You get it by trolling
everybody that you know by, you know, like, hey, go KKK. You know, I mean, I'm sorry. Did I say that?
The Webcast Beacon Network does not support the KKK whatsoever.
When you say it like that, it doesn't really sound a whole lot better, does it?
No. No, he doesn't. But, you know, if he really wanted to seal the deal, he would have finished it with it going, you know, I'm sorry, I understand what I said. I'm going into rehab to have my issues with women. And that would have been, you know, that would have been the slow clap, well played, thank you very much. You have done an excellent job here. But no, I think the big thing with him was, once he stirred the pot, he didn't know what to do with it. And his answer was, I'm just going to keep stirring, which was the wrong answer. And
the thing is, he's spent a lot of his career telling his audience, we're smarter than those guys. And with his little Charlie Sheen episode, I feel like he ended up presenting himself as saying, I'm smarter than you. That's not as appealing.
No.
It's entertaining for the short term, but we all know that they don't know that it's not going to work.
You know?
Right. Well, it's a new social media age, and we all have to adapt to it. And anybody who's been working in the field for 10 years or longer has a new paradigm to get used to. At this point, I think we're heading into our first break. We'll return shortly and spread more knowledge into your life.
The Geek Life Podcast is, get this, a discussion of all things geek. Technology, movies, television, books, comics, games, nothing is off limits.
Renew!
Sigh.
Renew!
What's this red blinking light?
I had that removed twice. Did you know that the MPAA film rating system began on November 1st?
No wonder we get all moody in the winter.
Know. You know, I wasn't going to say that.
Would you like some syrup?
Join Mike, Paul, Richard, and Melissa at The Geek Life Podcast at thegeeklife.tv.
This program is a part of the Webcast Beacon Network and is hosted on the Rampage Network. Follow us on Twitter at Webcomic Beacon. Email us at webcomicbeacon@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail by calling 1-320-310-0922. The Webcast Beacon Network, covering and promoting creativity and the creative process since 2007. Webcomics, comic news, tropes, and web fiction at webcastbeacon.com. Now, back to our show.
Number 11. Genre diversity in periodical comics. This has been a persistent theme for a long time in dealing with comic strips, and particularly comic books, that the superhero genre devours all. We haven't seen a gigantic shift this year, but when DC Comics introduced its new 52 comics series, 52 new periodicals that were starting at number one each, the percentage of superhero books and kind of sort of borderline superhero books was somewhat less than it had been in the past, maybe 73%, depending on how you count. There were a couple of sectors that were just barely tinged with the superhero genre at all.
Right, right.
This corresponds to DC Comics shifting to same-day digital delivery, which we'll get to later on. And I wonder if it reflects an awareness that their marketplace and their potential marketplace are slowly changing. Could this be a sign that we might finally break the stranglehold?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the thing I was saying earlier, that comics, you know, between the movies that they've had and the success of various different multiple media things, comics and geekdom as a whole is becoming a significantly more culturally acceptable pastime. And as it rises, as its stock rises in culture, it carries everything else upward, including some of the lesser ones, like, you know, the non-superhero comics. That it's sort of like when that movement in the 90s, when, you know, this isn't a comic, this is a graphic novel.
Oh, yes.
It steps up the cultural, you know. Comics aren't just for kids anymore. There are compelling stories going on. There are interesting things for everybody. And with the digital same day, with only having to invest the cost of creation and not necessarily of production, it also opens up their ability to experiment more with different forms, you know, because it wouldn't just be, you know, if they decided to start up a Western line, it wouldn't just be hiring people, getting a story, registering trademarks, creating it. There's also the huge sink of printing it. And with digital, they can use that as a canary in a coal mine so that they can tell, you know, this is where the market's headed, this is what people are interested in. It just, I think it's a good time for them to be experimenting with diversification like this.
It's funny you should mention Westerns, because it's always been a cyclical thing in publishing. Superheroes were very big in the 40s and then almost died off. Mm-hmm. Westerns and romance were 50s. Superheroes came back in the 60s, but so did war comics. And each time you can see the rise and falls of different genres. I think superheroes nowadays, the comic books are being propelled by the other medias. But I think if it were up to the comic books themselves, a lot of the decisions made by the big publishers have really gone through, and I think they've almost backfired in some ways. There's been a bit of a backlash. The New 52 echoes back to the 70s with the DC explosion, or as we call it in the industry, the DC implosion, where they lost a lot of their titles. you know, the One More Day. I mean, when you...
I don't even read...
go through and isolate and tick off so many people with a personal decision like that, there's going to be the backlash on that. Mm-hmm. And the way that... I'll give that to Joe Quesada. The way that he handles people at the conventions is a lot better than they were seeing by his counterparts over at DC, who seem to take great delight in ticking off the fanboys and fangirls.
I would conject that
it covers a lot of ground.
A lot of it is an act of desperation. I mean, you have to admit, the numbers for print comic books are nowhere near where they were in the heyday. Absolutely. I mean, there are a handful of web comics that put their numbers to shame. But, you know, one of the things about the New 52 is, in all my wisdom, I started a brand new project for the Webcast Beacon Network called First Issue, where me and a couple other nerds review comics, and I would say I'm an absolute newbie to print comics like this. And as a new reader, I am fairly impressed by many of the titles, and some titles are more disgusting than others. But, you know, I did notice that, you know, I had the superhero mindset in mind, but there are a few that, you know, the war comic with Sergeant Rock, where it focuses, you know, it's just a war comic. There's no superheroes in it. Or Animal Man, which has the perception that it kind of starts off as a superhero comic, but it's honestly a horror comic. And there's a few other titles in there. Dead Man isn't really even a superhero comic right now, it isn't. It's got that different flavor to it, and it's using this opportunity, I think, to see what the market is going to want. Obviously, you got to be concerned about the existing readers, but there's a lot more potential new readers out there than there are existing readers for them anyway.
Well, and that's a lot of the mentality that's gone into it. But from a business standpoint, and leaving out the fan aspect of it, this was a scattergun shot where you shoot out as much things as possible and see what actually hits. And this is, I mean, for it to have been done in this way, it was, I mean, we've seen since the beginning of the current co-publishers a lot of the usual media hype. It's basically everything that we saw from Marvel and Image in the 90s. You know, the special covers, the special editions, the number one issues. You know, I'm waiting for the next thing for them to copy over. And it really is that to go through and infuriate so many people just because you're losing two people for every new person you pick up.
I don't know. You know, it's getting easier and easier to infuriate everybody.
Yeah, it's a small sector of fandom that that has its own particular politics, and I think it's going to it's going to be very dissatisfied as it might find the immense superhero universe is beginning to shrink in response to pursuing opportunities in other genres. That won't all be good. That won't the immense super crossovers may be nearing their end for better and for worse. What I really want to say before we wrap up, and we do need to move on, is I've always said that the distribution power of the internet is the reason that comics have exploded out into these wildly different genres represented by XKCD and Pete and Penny Arcade and Sluggy Freelance and a dozen others that could roll off your tongue. But there are certain kinds of comics like, say, romance and Western that haven't worked very well with the online comics one-page format, but also haven't really had a place in the traditional comic book direct market. And they may see opportunities opening up for themselves in the next 2 to 5 years. Moving on to the next topic, Archie.
Yes.
The little publisher you thought would be out of business by now.
Can we refer to it as "Ugh, my balls hurt, Archie"? Because I will never forget that story.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that.
I guess we will. That is an Archie related story that I am not familiar with.
Oh. However,
I am familiar with the fact that they are the only comics company to publish a book that guest stars both Barack Obama and Sarah Palin. They are partnered with Random House. They beat Marvel and DC Comics to a digital strategy this year. They continue to publish an unbelievably complex sci-fi tinged story of its characters' possible future lives. Seriously, Life with Archie is the most ambitious reinvention since the days of Watchmen. And continuing their pattern of grabbing headlines with stories actually worth reading, they've just announced upcoming stories about interracial marriage and the first gay marriage to be published in comic books.
At least mainstream. Or theirs.
At least mainstream, yes. I haven't tracked all the minor companies. It's probably somebody who got to that goal first, but they've beaten Marvel and DC to that goal as well.
Well, part
when
of the
quote from a representative sums up the company's stance: "We don't care if bigots don't like our comics." But in the midst of all this celebration, it's also worth noting that the company is plagued by a bitter struggle between its co-CEOs, hurling back and forth accusations of sexism and sexual harassment way out of line with Archie's traditional image.
Penis, 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 penis. My balls
penis,
hurt.
Penis, penis. Yes, I don't know if you've covered this in previous podcasts. I hope you have.
Penis, 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 penis.
Does everybody know what is being referred to there?
Listen, it was in the newscast. It was months ago, but it was in the newscast. The female CEO of Archie Comics went around the room, pointed at every person, and said, penis, 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 and then said, ugh, my balls hurt, and left.
She's apparently been sexually harassed against.
Penis.
So.
I hadn't heard about the balls. I hadn't gotten the whole story.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a whole package.
Yeah, yeah, it's wonderful.
Well, it sounds like it was a whole package, but that's interesting.
Like she kind of got shafted.
We have, I do want to jump in here to be why one of the reasons why Archie is so successful, behind the scenes drama and scandal notwithstanding, is that they're the only comic that continues to be sold in grocery stores, unlike the stupid decision that Marvel and DC did by not putting them there anymore.
It's a combination of it's a chain of decisions that have led them to this point. Marvel and DC publish material that is often considered to be more adult and less family friendly.
Certainly.
And even though they have put out various kids lines in the last 20 years, they haven't done so with a degree of consistency. I should add, by the way, that that while it's very juicy and I would really like to believe it, the penis and balls story is still considered an allegation at this point. And there are several people at Archie Comics who are willing to confirm it, but it is true that for all their aggressive moves into the 21st century, there is a section of Archie management that is extremely conservative and male. So I can't really come down on either side of this one yet. I need more data.
Alrighty.
Are we going to the next one?
We shall.
Okay. Next story. Should be a short one because I don't really have anything to say about it other than yay. Web cartoonists jump to other media. This trend has been building for a while, but 2011 saw it out in force. Dr. McNinja's Chris Hastings landed a high-profile Marvel assignment at Deadpool, and he's reported that he'll probably be doing more work. Dinosaur Comics' Ryan North will be writing comics adaptations of the hugely successful TV series Adventure Time. Last Blood, a comics series from Keenspot, has been put into development, as has an offhand idea from Penny Arcade. And most promising of all, Cyanide and Happiness looks to be coming to Comedy Central, and frankly, I think it's got the potential to be their next South Park.
No.
This is definitely a yay because it shows that webcomics has always been the non-traditional route at allowing people who don't go through New York or who go through Los Angeles to get their material out there. And seeing some of these success stories shows that it is working.
Right. I mean, in the case of Cyanide and Happiness, I mean, they've been gearing towards this. That's why they started doing all the animated shorts that they've been doing for the last 2 years and putting so much effort into them is to try and go in this route. Not to mention, they've got an agent. I mean, so they're working within the system, but they're making it work for them. And a lot of the bigger ones are doing this now, trying to get an agent and trying to head in that direction. I mean, if you look at the case of the one I can't think of who was trying... Oh, Perry Bible Fellowship. There it is. He was trying to get a deal doing script writing in Hollywood and was able to use PBF to get towards that goal.
I do want to clarify the Cyanide and Happiness thing. It's a part of a larger clip show, so it's likely going to be like the small little bits that they've been doing within the show. It's not like they're absolutely their own show. That I think that would be way too much for people.
So they're basically in the situation that the Simpsons was when it debuted as part of the Tracy Ullman show. Mm. Obviously that worked out very well for the Simpsons, but there were lots of other segments of the Tracy Ullman show that we're not seeing in prime time today.
And we've also seen things like Dilbert, Baby Blues, and so many others that just didn't make the transition well.
That's true.
I think Baby Blues is really good.
But it was UPN,
which
a positive step forward. Is one of our members being arrested? I hear sirens in the background.
It's got to be Eric.
I hear a laptop fan.
All right. Moving on to the success story that nobody knows about. Marvel takes Broadway. Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark was the musical every entertainment critic loved to hate, lambast, criticize, and laugh at. And its early weeks were almost a literal disaster with repeated injuries on set. But a funny thing happened after the laughter and the pain died down. The show was retooled. And while critical response never rose above lukewarm, it's now definitely a profitable enterprise, which is notable given that it was, up to this point, the most expensive Broadway production ever produced. Comics and Broadway have a history together. You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, Lil Abner, and Annie. But that history hasn't included any recent landmarks. I'm honestly not certain whether it's perceived failure by the media or its actual financial success is the more important factor here, but I'd place my bets with the actual financial success.
The bottom line is usually the bottom line. And whereas I don't think Turn Off the Dark will be the memorable success that It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman was, I do think that it is, again, showing more of comic books and the comic medium making a transition to mainstream.
I think it's a better story when it was failing than it is succeeded. This is why we stopped hearing about it once it started working. I mean, Wait,
when did it work? I missed the working part. I mean, I know it, like, people stopped dying, but
people stopped singing, and they've successfully performed it many times without anyone catching on fire or being repeatedly slammed into a cinder block wall. Admittedly,
the bar for success was originally set pretty low in the early months, but we are looking at a profit margin at this point, which incidentally I did not know until I researched the story for the purpose of this podcast.
Is this kind of like The Producers, where they tried to make a complete flop to get all the money or something? That's what it sounds like. It sounds like this could not have been on purpose. I mean, Bono's involved.
U2 was involved. In fact, they did the music for it, and they were heavily involved in the retooling as well.
That's funny.
What hey, I'm can still I holding out you? Hope for the Captain America musical.
Oh, I don't like musicals. I don't like Broadway musicals. I think we could move on.
All right. Fair enough. A moment of silence, please, for our number 7 story, The Death of the Comics Code. Archie Comics, them again, rejected the code at the beginning of the year, which was the final nail in its coffin. DC, Marvel, and most other major publishers had done so a few years prior. The code was a symbol of censorship for a long period of its 56-year history, but it was also a sign of standardization. And while individual publishers have created new guidelines to their work's age appropriateness, you'll sometimes see an all ages label or a teen plus 13, teen plus 16, teen plus 43, such guidelines are self-imposed and self-enforced
there isn't the universality of PG-13, which most people understand and don't need to be educated about on a continual basis. That's just not part of any comics marketing strategy, and given the way things are going, I doubt that it will be at any point in the next 10 years.
I think they adopted the video game rating system more closer than, say, TV or movies.
That's true.
Well, if you listen carefully, you can hear that whirring sound, and that is Frederick Wortham spinning in his grave. Seduction of the Innocent has had a stake in it put for the final time. The Comics Code was created because of the sensationalistic nature of Seduction of the Innocent by Dr., making air quotes around that, Frederick Wortham, and his views upon the comic book world, especially with things towards EC Comics, with the horror and the graphicness of the stories there. Yeah.
It was... Congress is kind of looking, as far as I understand, Congress is kind of looking at comics and be like, should we regulate them, sort of thing? And then some of the other comic companies ganged up, basically, on EC Comics. You know, the ones that did, like, you know, the good, interesting horror stuff, the more risque stuff, the more interesting bits. Against them, created this sort of comics code, came up with all these rules that basically limited creativity and said you had to have this, you had to have that. Bad guys had to do this. Cops had to be like that. You couldn't show this. You couldn't show that. And it basically worked because the public would look for this symbol now, would stop buying the other comics just because it wasn't there, effectively drilling them into the ground.
Because look at the way that EC got around it. What happened? MC Games got out of the comic book industry and created magazines, most notably Mad Magazine.
There you go.
To where the comic book code does not hold sway. But yeah, it was all self-imposed to make sure that Congress did not step in and regulate them, because we see how well that works whenever they do anything. And finally seeing the death of it, I mean, seeing the end of the comics code after 50-plus years is certainly a notable thing.
Well, I think the comics code may also be tie into one of the things we were talking about earlier, the upswing of some of the non-superhero style comics that not specifically, like, they were like, woohoo, the comics code is finally dead, now it's safe to come back. But the fact that the comics code has died and the fact that those style of comics are coming back may not be completely corollary. They're probably not strongly causal, but they may be corollary in that it's the comic book industry as a whole growing up.
Well, Archie was the last one to even have it, weren't they?
Yes.
So yeah,
DC did not discard it that long prior.
Right. The war comics, the horror comics, I mean, a lot of those were around in the 70s under the comics code. They skirted it and they towed the line very closely, but they did have those particular types of stories. So saying that because it's gone, these genres will be coming back. They were back when we had the code
I'm saying they're coming back, and that's why it's gone. I'm saying it's actually sort of the other way around, that comics have grown up enough to the point where we want that sort of a story back in it. And that's one of the things that has rendered the comics code useless, is because the comics code only worked so long as people were cooperating with it. We've said we want our horror, we want our nudity and our swearing, and we want Batman to eventually be able to have sex. For the love of God, please let Batman have sex. Do you have any idea how many people in the Gotham slums probably get punched repeatedly in the face each night just because Batman can't go home and have sex?
Hey, if you ask Frederick Wortham, he was getting it on a regular basis, just not with Selina Kyle.
And even Archie Comics wants the freedom, apparently, to do a story that mentions drugs. That's oversimplifying a little bit. The restrictions from the code have loosened over time, but one of the most public cases where it became relevant was in the late 60s, Stan Lee, who one wouldn't really associate with radical pushing the R-rated envelope, wanted to do a Spider-Man story that addressed drugs. And you could not have a story that was code-approved that featured drugs. So he simply published the three-issue story without the code seal of approval. And that was one of the little chisel marks that led to where we are today. I'm sorry to have hogged that because now we probably need to take a break, but we'll be back shortly and I will try to speak less.
Dazzling and we fight to breathe, it's New Year's Eve, and I can feel you in my bloodstream. I'm rock and roll, I feel like James Dean. They're rolling out and we're rolling in, recovering like I'm forever 19. I'm in a constant state of daydream, yeah. I'm gonna put the flame back in this fire. I'm gonna walk myself out on the wire. I'm gonna put the street back in this fight. Never say die. We take the lead and the crowd's forever following. And everyone I know is right here. And everything I love is so clear.
That was New Year's Eve by Special Patrol, found at musicalley.com by Mevio.
Yeah, the comics code in particular, I mean, it's been such a big part of comics history, you know, even though it didn't directly impact my life in a really noticeable way in the last 10 years, I still can't believe it's gone.
I can, because it was primarily a symbol of things that people don't want to think about. I mean, because the 50s, the quote, innocence of the 50s has such a negative connotation to people nowadays that things like that, the comics code, reflect things that people don't want to have to deal with.
That's true, and that's meaning for a lot of people. And since I became aware of comics history, that's a large part of its meaning for me. But but I remember growing up and going to the comic books on the spinner rack and being told at a certain point, this little seal means that this comic is safe for you to read, and that and I was a sensitive kid. That actually that was actually kind of reassuring to me.
And I agree. I mean, to me, having those restrictions actually made some of them better writers because they had to go through and work within those constraints. It's too easy for someone to say, I'm the goddamn Batman, as opposed to having to express himself without taking those lazy shortcuts.
But if they want
to teaching Batman Miller, to express himself without profanity is important.
But if they want to make those sort of decisions, they should be free to make those sort of decisions, because then they're decisions and not like being forced
impositions.
To.
Exactly. It should be based upon the individual editors and publishers as opposed to an overreaching. I mean, the reason the Comics Code got started, as we said, was because one guy had a hard-on about the way the comics were being dealt with.
Possibly quite literally.
Yeah, well, with Frederick Wortham, I mean, I could believe it.
Yeah, Frederick Wortham, there's another show topic for you if you care to go in that direction.
The thing is that it basically forced everybody to be PG, which, I mean, you could say restrictions can heighten one's creativity, but it's so restrictive that, you know, I mean, you can easily do a lot of the stuff that you couldn't talk about. You could still have good quality PG stories utilizing that content. I think the rating system is a lot better sort of stepped evaluation. However, when I look at Teen Plus on a copy of Voodoo Number 1 from DC Comics New 52, and I open up the book, and then almost the entire damn comic is tits and ass in underwear, and I was like, this better be like 17 plus, 16 plus at least. I'm looking at this and it's like, I'm getting uncomfortable. And it's like, yes, I don't mind seeing this sort of stuff, but just...
But thinking about who else might be seeing it.
But just right off the shelf, something like this, the content that was in it was like, I think you're pushing it. You do know that people can readily go get porn on the internet for free, right? I'm not going to pay $3 for a crappy comic.
It's funny
comic.
To say that, because one of the things that I always had, I mean, remember back to the founding of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. I used to go to Friendly Frank's up in the Chicagoland area, and they had the adult and the mature comics off in a different area separated, and that they got sued over that.
What?
And now you've got things that are easily crossing over into some of these areas, out to where kids can just go into the shop and get it themselves.
Yeah,
I mean,
I'm not saying
them?
Get rid of them. I'm just saying it's like there should be a little bit more responsibility.
Exactly. And that's always been one of my things, is that the responsibility lies on the parents. I mean,
well,
come on, Terrence. I wish we were recording right now, because I say, parents, watch your kids and some of the stuff that they're reading. Just don't let them go off willy-nilly.
You
don't have to have Little Lulu, but you don't have to have Omaha the Cat Dancer either.
Right. And I am recording. I just don't know how much of this I'm going to keep before we actually...
My whole argument about...
You're never safe on this podcast. You can never be sure.
My whole thing against the Comics Code would be, imagine that instead of comics, it was movies. Now, movies have a similar thing, where, like, if you don't get a rated R, if you get rated X, or you're unrated, they won't play you in a majority of theaters. But imagine if the bar was that much lower and it was like PG or PG-13. And think about every movie that's come about since the 60s, and imagine it neutered to get it under the bar.
But also take a look at the way that mores have changed. I mean, the first X-rated movie to win an Academy Award was Midnight Cowboy. And they're showing that on broadcast TV now. It's not... things
times change.
But it's also, to me, it's not so much movies as it is the current crop of video games. I mean, at least in movie theaters, you will have people go through and say, you know, you're looking a little young to be in an R-rated movie without your parents. But they can go and buy a copy of Grand Theft Auto with no problem.
They're supposed to check your ID.
No, we're actually supposed to stop them from doing that, too.
Yeah, they are.
Well, we're definitely proving that this is a that this topic could be grist for a podcast all its own.
And but I think we need to continue.
Wow.
Back to the remaining items.
Well, as long as I get to make fun of Frederick Wortham more, I'm more happy for that.
All right, number six.
All right, number six. Susie Cagle and the Occupy Movement. Political cartoonist and daughter of the renowned Daryl Cagle, Susie got involved with Occupy protests in Oakland, unfairly arrested, then released with charges. I'm actually not quite certain at this point whether the charges were dropped or whether the charges remain in a state of limbo or whether the charges will be dropped and her arrest record will be released. Anybody who wants to chime in with that one later is welcome to. Though she'd prefer to be considered a journalist rather than a cartoonist. Her story shows how the two occupations can blur and the courage that sometimes requires. We've seen other cartoonist journalists like Art Spiegelman and Joe Sacco and the works that they've created. This is a cartoonist who happens to be on the ground during one of the most most important movements of the year, and we see the early stages of a new graphic history taking form.
Mm-hmm. The thing with the blurred occupations, it depends on what technical definition the Constitution refers to as press. Because anybody with a blog can be a journalist. Technically,
actually, no, they can't. They recently had an article, number of stories about a blogger who tried using press credentials to get out of something, and it was ruled in a court of law. Bloggers are not necessarily journalists.
Yeah, but
just because you have a blog does not mean that you get your press rights.
Oh, right. I mean, a blog is a blog, but it also depends on the type of contact. You know, this is something, you know, we can argue semantics over the definition of what a journalist is. I could argue that the entire cast and crew of the Webcomic Beacon newscast are journalists, producing a regular piece of content that's broadcasted weekly on the internet. I, you know, it's just, to some people, that's journalism. To some people, it may not be. Though it's also a bit of punditry as well, I will admit.
But with this story, I mean, there's a couple of questions that immediately ask. I mean, it says that she was unfairly arrested. I mean, was she observing or was she participating? If she was observing, then her claim as a journalist is very valid. Mm-hmm. If she was participating, that immediately blows the objectivity, which is the core fundamentalism, is supposed to be, of being a journalist.
I would say from her story that she was observing. And perhaps it was my misstatement that she got involved. She got involved in the sense that she was
arrested
in the vicinity and was arrested for participating. And I suppose that it's true that I'm pretty much taking her word and the word of the courts that her observation was just that.
Well, alrighty.
Moving on to number five, Kickstarter. We're starting to get into the trend pieces rather than the individual events. Kickstarter may have been founded in 2009 and may have gained most of its initial momentum in 2010, but it seemed to be everywhere this year with regard to comics projects.
Oh, yeah.
It not only funded several high profile ventures, which you guys can discuss in more detail, but it was listed, according to one study, as the third largest independent publisher of graphic novels, for a loose but important definition of publisher.
I do want to mention, just because we mentioned Kickstarter, that there is an alternate sort of fundraiser sort of thing that mm-hmm. works differently than Kickstarter. I believe it's called Indiegogo.
I've heard of that.
And just throwing that out there as something else that people can also look into, research your options. But yeah, Kickstarter's been everywhere. I think Neil Gaiman and Amanda Palmer had a Kickstarter for something too. So it's not just, you know,
they raised a stupid amount of money with it too.
Yeah.
It was stupid how much money they raised with it.
It's just, you know, and then Kickstarter in turn gets a percentage of that. And in that case, a stupid amount of money and a percentage.
Yeah, seriously. My good friend Dern, who's been on the newscast a couple of times, he tried to raise $500 with a Kickstarter that got then picked up by Boing Boing and Laughing Squid, and he's at around 10 grand for it right now.
Well, he also hit it really, really low for like a minimal sort of a print. And like every, you know, because the way the Kickstarter it works is that with every level of donation, you can get this, you can get that, you can get two copies of, like, say, a book or something like that if you're selling comic books or something or some sort of project. And that more and more money just means that, hey, I can place a bigger order now. It's possible that it can even work lowballing like that, that you can at least get your minimal. And then, you know, good on you if you can go from there.
Yeah.
So I'd like to get them on the show sometime. Maybe I'll try to do that.
Ooh, Kickstarter?
Kickstarter.
Maybe. Yeah, I bet they'd do it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Kickstarter to me seems a bit like the modern version of P.T. Barnum. Yeah. No, because anybody can put anything up and there are going to be enough suckers out there to do it.
Well, before it was invite only. It was invite only for a long time.
It's... Has it changed to a level that that anyone can do it?
I think it's
because
more,
I remember I had to argue my case.
I think it's more open now, but before, at least in like 2009, 2010, you had to know somebody who was there and then would recommend you.
Yeah, it's open. It's definitely open.
Okay.
Well, when I launched a Kickstarter project earlier this year, I was asked to present my argument for why this proposal would be worthy.
Did you manage to fit it in the time allotted?
It was a written proposal, but I was not successful the first time. I had to go back, retool, and try again. So I know that they are. I know that they observed at least that level of exclusivity. When I was working with them earlier this year.
Well, already. Something for people to investigate. Again, Indiegogo is another alternative for some of those who might be considering their options. We should move on to number four.
We never claim to give you all the information on this program.
No. Never.
We never claim to give you information on this program.
Eh.
Moving on to topic number four, the condensation of print distribution. This year saw in fairly rapid succession the bankruptcy of Borders and the complete closing down of United Media Syndicate, the latter of which surrendered its business to Universal UClick, the former of which de facto surrendered most of its business to Barnes & Noble and Books A Million.
Wow.
The distribution of printed graphic novels, and especially of comic strips, therefore edges closer to monopoly. It's probably worth mentioning in the same general vein that the condensation of the newspaper industry continues slowly but steadily.
We're seeing a lot of that in all major businesses, though, because whether it be the telecommunications with things like the AT&T attempt buyout of T-Mobile and others to the banking industry, we are seeing a lot of businesses that a lot of old businesses that are not making the transition into the new millennia and are being gobbled up by those who are.
Also, it's fair to point out that it's a monopoly in the same way that the like the one company still making typewriter ribbon is a monopoly. Monopolies happen when all your competition is driven out of business.
You can have a technical monopoly, yes, of course.
Yeah, it's a technical monopoly. It's not like they're forcing other people to not do it anymore. The model is becoming less and less sustainable, and they're less the Highlander and more the Will Smith in the zombie movie.
So you're saying my 100 shares of Buggy Whip Unlimited is still safe?
Speaking of which, Eric Kimball had written a sort of Buggy Whips for the Future two-part article on Webcomic Z. I'll try to remember to link that in this show as well. It just popped in my head. So,
but this topic certainly definitely rolls into our number three as well.
Yeah.
Yes, well, number three is digitization of print periodicals. After a glacial pace in the first decade of this century, which set my teeth on edge during several similar retrospectives to this one, nearly every publisher announced some digital content strategy over the last 2 years, and this year saw the standardization of same-day digital release among DC, Marvel, and many other publishers, which I think constitutes a major tipping point. Distributors have started to respond, and even major bookstore chains have gotten involved. Barnes & Noble and Books A Million have refused to sell printed copies of DC Comics that they couldn't sell online due to an exclusive arrangement with Amazon. Meanwhile, Diamond Comics Distributors faces reports that, if true and if representative of all the facts, put its founder in severe debt, leading to questions about that company's stability. And this is the problem with some monopolies. Unlike Borders and United Media Syndicate, Diamond has no competitors that can do what it does for comics. I think that we're going to see more developments on this front in 2012, and I'm hoping that the good outpaces the bad.
I actually think this is a good thing, because Diamond has had a stranglehold on the publishing industry for comic books for a long time. I don't think we're going to be seeing the end of Diamond, because they do distribute more than just comic books, but it was certainly their major thing for a long time. Getting some other form of distribution away from them is going to be expanding out the market for a lot of the companies, especially the small independent ones that could not break into the business because of Diamond's stranglehold.
Well, that is a valid point, and it's certainly what I would consider a best case scenario. I would feel a lot better about it if there were any legitimate competitors that seemed like they could expand out from 1% to 5% to 10% of the market and eventually overtake the market, as in many ways Apple did with Microsoft. What we have right now, though, is I wonder if we have a too big to fail scenario. If Diamond were simply to declare bankruptcy.
Yeah.
Like I said, the three big ones, Dark Horse, Marvel, and DC. I mean, especially Marvel and DC, having Warner and Disney behind them now, would easily be able to handle their own distribution.
Marvel has Disney.
That's what I said.
No, well, DC, like has, Disney has, DC has Warner Brothers.
Yeah, DC is Warner Brothers. Marvel is Disney.
Right.
And it,
yes, in the sense of major companies that could fall that they could fall back upon for distribution's sake.
Right.
I think some. What about
the
ones,
what
though?
About the independents though? I know that the that it is often considered a bone of contention that Diamond Comics isn't fair enough to independent publishers, but I got to tell you, in a world where DC and Marvel are distributing their own material, independent publishers like me, and by the way, I'm coming out with a with something in the Diamond catalog for January, we'd be pretty much screwed. At least in terms of distributing to traditional print direct market
have to
shops.
Distribution yourself, you have to go through. I mean, do your own advertising, which can be done. Get people to place the orders with yourself, and even then, there is such there. Well, at least before recent years, there was such a stigma against people who did not distribute through Diamond. A lot of the comic shops wouldn't do it.
Do you want me to? Do you want me to send mail order advertisements to the remaining comic book shops in the country?
That's what you might have to do. That just might have to be what it is.
I tried that back in 1999, and I don't know how successful it was. But I think that if I, the fact that I could refer them to the publication that they pick up and regularly flip through every month was a big advantage that that made it more effective than it otherwise would be.
Well, in the 80s and 90s, I mean, there were other options as well. I mean, the Comic Buyer's Guide, I mean, you could distribute through some of the larger comic chains such as Lone Star Comics or Heroes World. You could advertise in other comics themselves. But everything slowly, I mean, that's the problem with a monopoly, is that everything slowly gets under control of one company, and they get to play God with the materials.
I'm not pro-monopoly, don't get me wrong. I just don't want to see the monopoly, in this case, collapse all at once, because I think that could lead to some serious shockwaves that the comic book market might not be equipped to recover from at this point.
Well, absolutely. If Diamond were to take a major hit, we would see, I mean, even more than digital distribution, we would be seeing the end of the mom-and-pop comic book shop.
Well,
and the larger chains would be closing down a bunch of shops.
I could easily see a competitor to Diamond going virtual through the internet. Actually being able to interactive catalogs online, listing all of the potential merchandise that you could buy. I mean, it's time the system got some innovation. And Diamond has been hesitant to push any of that themselves because up until now, you know, monopoly. But I think once Diamond makes a break away from their standard distribution model to try something else, whatever they do, that's going to be when they're going to get jumped on by competition.
Yes. That seems like as good a place as any to leave things. The number two story is net neutrality and internet rights in general. This continues to be a battleground, but there are some positive signs. On September 23rd, the FCC issued directives for a free and open internet that insisted upon the transparency of network practices and equal access to lawful content. Two principles that continue to make the internet what it is today, and this is largely what people are talking about when they talk about net neutrality. The battle is not over, but this is a definitely a recognizable step forward. And the implications for the voices of individual cartoonists should probably be obvious. some politicians are still trying to overturn these rules, but they lack support. And also largely unsupported is the Protect IP Act, which would criminalize YouTube, never mind web cartoonists. The fact that these acts are even being proposed does point to the dangerous cluelessness that still resides within Congress, and a number of people are quick to point that out when discussing the final relevant piece of legislation, the Stop Online Piracy Act, which continues to be deliberated upon, and we probably will not see a resolution on that until March. I think that the Stop Online Piracy Act, while very dangerous to independent producers, will ultimately fail in a political climate that depends upon young voters in increasing numbers, and particularly if it is given a chance to be vetoed, because say what you will about Barack Obama, but he has certainly benefited from the internet as it is today and understands its implications much more than any occupant of the White House before him, even its alleged creator.
I would like to point out here, because Tom, we talked about this on a previous newscast. Tom did bring up that the way that SOPA is written, it mainly, you don't have to worry about it if you are a U.S. server. Is that correct, Tom?
Not just a U.S. server. If you have any tie to it, an owner, it's hosted here, whatever, a business connection to the U.S., SOPA does not apply. You have to be... There are a number of criteria that SOPA has to go through. One, you have to be foreign, period. You know, you have to be hosted overseas. You have to have owners overseas. There cannot be a U.S. citizen involved with that.
The problem
is that there are certain criteria you have to meet before any action can be taken. And unlike the current situation, right now, they really don't have to do anything. There are no legislations. There are no procedures for what they want to do. SOPA does go through and lay down procedures that they have to go through. To be able to do all this stuff that you can do in SOPA, you have to get a court order. You have to get notification. You have to receive from the people that you're notifying. And then they can take action in SOPA. But it is 100% foreign.
However, that includes everything that's not U.S., including Canada, Australia, the United Kingdom, greater parts of Europe. You know, other countries that we...
I haven't had a very long-standing relationship with a Canadian cartoonist. We've done a lot of work together, and several others with Finns and cartoonists in the UK and Australia. While it's somewhat reassuring that this isn't quite as broad-based as I originally thought, it doesn't make me feel like we're necessarily out of danger. I would say my basic position on this is don't panic, but be vigilant.
Exactly. And there's a lot of stuff in there that I approve of. I believe that there is a rampant society out there that that will go through and is involved with piracy. I mean, the biggest target of this is obviously the Pirate Bay. And one of the things it says in SOPA is that you have to be dedicated. That word is in there, dedicated to piracy. So one of the sites that a friend of mine has been going to and reading of is one of our sister web organizations, and that's that guy with the glasses.com. And a lot of the furor that's over there is a lot of misunderstanding because the fair use still goes into play. And it's the whole misinterpretation, and it's being blown out of proportion.
As a former Sprite comic artist, I will say, fair use will only protect you up to a certain point, even if you are legitimately using it. I wasn't like I'm going to steal Sonic sprites. I was a Sprite person, but I like drew my own sprites. But I researched the crap out of fair use, both for the sprites that I did make, and then when I was doing the Apple of Discord, all the movie parodies and stuff. But fair use is one of those things. It's a very subjective sort of thing. Like, you have to...
It's not well-defined right now.
Yeah, it's not well-defined, and it's a dangerous thing to try to fall back on.
Well, and that actually is a great thing about with SOPA, is people go through, I mean, because we can talk about fair use and some of this other stuff all we want. SOPA is completely the U.S. federal government. Criminal actions. That does not stop Sony from suing a Sprite comic, because that takes place in the civil courts. SOPA has nothing to do with civil. SOPA has nothing to do with businesses. Those avenues are still open to them. It is solely about what the U.S. federal government can do.
Maybe
and
we should,
it boils down to, you know, they can shut off access for both through the DNS, through search engines, and through financial means.
Of all the stories that I researched for this piece, this was the one that I felt that I needed to research the most, and I think that there is still a great deal of research yet to be done. I'd really like to discuss this with you all further, but for the sake of the running time, I'm just say that it does. There do seem to be some serious efforts to define exactly where the lines of piracy and fair use are, and that's got some serious implications for everyone who does something creative online, definitely including the comic sphere. The number one story, though, is a brighter affair. This was the year when, according to Know Your Meme and the people who track such trends in internet usage, the Rage comic became a thing, something that was traded and passed back and forth. Quickie image manipulation has been part of the internet for years, but the Rage comic is a special and wonderfully expressive mutation of memes that has branched out recently, and it has even been seen to be practiced by an octogenarian who used the forum to tell the story of his life in a moving piece that made its way around many corners of the internet late this year. As expressive as the original emoticons with the playfulness of the later lolcats, it's a subgenre that shows sometimes the most remarkable work in cartooning can still be done anonymously, can still bubble up from the bottom of our culture like slang or and I think that's really remarkable, and I think that's the kind of story that we often tend to miss when we just concentrate on what made the headlines this year.
It's something I continue to
study and see if I can adopt certain aspects of it in my own work. What say you guys? This was the one I anticipated being most controversial as being on the list at all.
Well,
oops.
Oh, that would have been bad.
Yes. Okay. I wanted to jump in here and mention not so much just Rage comics. I'd put it the number one here, but with that, like any one of those where you see like there's like a head crop against a background of spiraled colors with some sort of kitschy
The image memes.
Yeah, the image memes.
Yeah.
You know,
Scumbag Steve.
The whole. I don't even throw Tumblr in here as well. Just Owl. Just the overall massive sharing of image content memes. You know, they're not sharing like a written post anymore. They're sharing entire ideas in images, and it's rampant. It is incredibly rampant in 2011. Not just with the Cheeseburger Network. Which, by some people say, is where memes go to die, but also Tumblr and its reblogging, its more sophisticated Twitter with retweets that properly credit everybody from who originally made this post or whatever, and so it's just like this STD of the internet, basically. It's just
I'd argue that we're witnessing something somewhere between the birth of a new form of comic and more almost the birth of a new form of communication.
Yeah.
That this is not just a comic. The Rage comics are comics, but it's not a comic to be displayed. It is a comic to communicate. It's like a picture text message sort of thing, except it's a drawing instead of a picture or a text message. It's a different form of communication that we've ever seen that's passing through the medium of comics and stuff as it goes from person to person.
It's absolutely tough to know where to draw these lines sometimes. I certainly feel like it's worth recognizing as either comics or so close that it has a measurable impact on our total universe anyway. I've seen the ideas from these image sharing memes start to filter into some online comics, and I've even participated in that, especially with Quiltback.
Well, I think the big difference here is who it's aimed at. Most people that make comics, like webcomics or comics, are aiming at a wide audience. We're aiming at everybody.
Anyone that can understand pictures and hopefully some text.
Hopefully. And that's why you have a website and you keep an archive and you sign them prominently so that people know that it's by you. This is a personal form of communication. I mean, even if it's something that you're only saying to the people like of 4chan, it still is an interpersonal, smaller group. It's much a more form of communication than it is a presentation like a standard comic used to be. And I think it's the point-to-point, the narrower spectrum of the broadcast, where sometimes, there's apps for the iPhone and Android where I've actually made an image macro specifically referring to something that somebody said and then texted it to somebody. It's not just somebody says something and then, you put the guy doing the facepalm as a response. on Facebook or something like that. It's communication itself.
Emoticon evolved.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And this is what it's all about to me. I have always thought of comics as this wonderful medium of communication of ideas, and the fact that people are finding new ways to use the words and the pictures and often the sequence, it just makes me feel better about working in the field. It reminds me of all the times in the late 1990s when I was being told that it was a dying art form. It's it's a great time in many ways to be alive.
Hooray!
Hooray! And with that, I think it's we're at the end of our year in review episode, clocking it at almost about 2 hours. I don't know. I'll come back with the final numbers, I'm sure.
And nobody died.
Yet.
Yet.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. It's been a pleasure.
Yes. I just want to go over everyone who has been here. I want to thank T. Campbell for taking up guest hosting duties for this episode.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be here. And the series I referred to, Quilt Bag, is available on where finest internets are sold. You can you should be able to find everything that I'm working on by going to tcampbell.net and particularly consulting the bar at the upper right.
Well, there you have it. And thanks again to Ross Scott, who made a return appearance, however quiet as he has may been during the show. But thank you for coming back.
I had to poop. you know, I don't have to poop out on every topic. Note. Sorry.
Yes.
I'll work on it. I'll have more opinions soon, I promise.
Sure, and you can check out his opinions at systemcomic.com. Thanks to Adam Smithy from the Tropecast and webcomichell.com for coming on the show and inputting his commentary and perspective on this show. Thanks again.
No problem. Also want to throw out the, I'm back to updating my epic sci-fi fantasy parody webcomic, applevalleycomic.com. So that's back again. I've been doing it for like a month now, so...
Yay. Hooray!
Hooray!
And there was much rejoicing.
And there was much rejoicing, yes. And thanks to Tom Revor.
Hey.
From, well, he's the new Webcomic Beacon newscast, podcast director and host. And it was also from the 910 CMX collective, as well as, I forget the other one.
Oh, I'm with a lot of people. But let me also go and say that for people who are interested, the Kickstarter alternative, Indiegogo, is I-N-D-I-Gogo. If you go to I-N-D-Y-Gogo, you end up with the strip club near Speedway.
Woo!
That's good, too.
But you lose money there and not make it.
Well, thanks, Tom, for coming. And hope you get back to your regularly scheduled newscasts next week.
That's so, right. I got to get back to work on that stuff.
Yep. Ugh. And again, thanks to the silent ninja Eric Kimball from Blade Bunny. Blade Bunny, yes. Because there's another comic called Blade something else. From BladeBunny.com.
Sure, there's a few. Yeah. Blades are popular this year.
Absolutely. And I have Ben Fess of ArdraComic.com. That is all for this year in review. We'll see you next year with more.